Anyone have any questions before we begin? Today I'm going to be talking about the road to Pearl Harbor, the expansion of the Second World War from a local European conflict, basically a conflict between Germany and the Western powers, Britain and France, to truly a world war, including Soviet Union, Japan, the United States, basically all of the major powers in the war. And this process whereby the war expanded from a European conflict to a global conflict took place over a period of about 2 years, September 1939, to the outbreak of the U.S.-Japanese War in December 7th, 1941, followed 4 days later by Germany's declaration of war on the United States. That's, everyone knows the basic story. Why is this story of interest for us? Because it relates to this kind of core set of issues that we're concerned with in this class. You know, you absorb a certain conventional sense for how international politics works. And that conventional sense is based on, you know, your understanding of these great conflicts of the 20th century, especially Second World War, the Cold War, and the ordinary inclination is to interpret those conflicts in moral terms. These were conflicts that had to do with aggressive powers. They were caused by aggression. Who could be more aggressive than Hitler? The attack on Pearl Harbor, an act of aggression, pure and simple. Of course it led to the war. End of story. Cold War, the United States, the Western Allies, they're the good guys. Look at the Soviets. Look how aggressive they were, and so on. Those views are very common and provided some basis for this common notion that's how international politics works. Very common view. Aggression causes wars. You want to figure out what caused the war. You try and figure out who's to blame, who the aggressor is. I mean, today, it's like here we are, 100 years after the outbreak of the First World War. And still, if you look at the way that issue is discussed, the whole question is Germany guilty? You know, who's guilty for the First World War, right? And it's important to understand that a body of thought took shape in reaction to those kind of central notions. This is the whole realist approach to international politics. I don't even want to say realist theory because it's not well defined enough to even be called a theory. It's more a kind of a sensibility. The idea is, it's not that simple. It's not like one side is going to be calling the shots, that the aggressive power is the one that's going to be forcing the pace of events. International politics, all the major powers have their say in determining how events run their course. Everyone is reacting to everyone else. There's a story here. And in trying to sort out that story, there's one set of factors that's of fundamental importance that lies at the heart of the logic of that story. And this is the whole question of power. Countries are concerned with their power position. They're concerned with their security. They're very worried about what's going to happen in the future. Is their freedom going to be, you know, narrowly circumscribed because of the rise of foreign centers of power that are going to circumscribe their freedom of action, right? And we saw how that way of looking at things, a way that emphasizes power considerations, helps you understand the coming of the Second World War, right? What was the key point in those lectures about September 1939? Hitler didn't want it. Right? This he you know, he thought a war with the West was inevitable in the future. Even then, he didn't really want it. What he wanted was a free hand in the East. Why could the West not give him a free hand in the East? Because of power factors. Because if Germany acquired a great empire in the East and controlled all the resources of, you know, continental Europe up to the Urals, then those resources would enable Germany to create such a vast military power that Britain, for example, would cease to be a free country. So you couldn't just sit on your hands and allow events to take their course. You know, you had to act preemptively. If as soon as it became clear that Germany was aiming at something more than gathering all the ethnic Germans of Europe into a single state, and that Germany was aiming at, you know, true European hegemony, true European supremacy, well, then you had to draw the line. And the British were intent on drawing the line and risking war in 1939 rather than just sitting on their hands and allowing things to, you know, get even. Right? So power considerations lay at the heart of British policy. Power considerations also played a certain role in shaping German policy. Right? Now, as we will see today, that whole way of looking at things views international politics as a process unfolding over time. In which power considerations play a central role. Doesn't mean that there's no such thing as aggression. Doesn't mean that moral judgments are entirely inappropriate in international politics. It simply means that these things are more complex than that, and that what you always want to try and do when you're seeking to understand these things is to figure out how the balance should be struck between moral factors and political factors, between structure and agency, you know, and you can only get insight into those questions by looking at the story in some detail, you know, more closely than most people do. Okay. Well, that's the context for what I want to do today, and talking about the story of how America ended up at war with Germany and Japan at the end of 1941. I also want to show you how you go about making up your mind about these issues. You know, give you some feel for the intellectual process that yields conclusions that are relevant to those questions that define the whole field of international relations. Okay? Okay. You all know the basic story of what happened after September 1939. No equivalent to the Schlieffen Plan. The Germans didn't immediately attack France by marching through Belgium or anything like that. Not in September 1939. There was a short war in the East. Germany conquered Poland. And in accordance with the terms of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, Poland was divided between the Soviets, who moved in at the end of September and took over the eastern part of Poland, and the Germans who took over the western part of Poland. Right? Rapid military decision. Right? But that was not followed by peace. Well, you know, Hitler had hoped it would, but the British weren't going to settle quite yet. And so the Germans geared up for a war against the Western powers. And in the spring of 1940, after, you know, whatever it was, about 8 months of what was called the phony war, the Germans attacked France, moving through Holland and Belgium this time. And France was defeated in about 6 weeks in the spring of 1940. By June 1940, France threw in the towel, left the war. Half of France was directly occupied by the Germans. The other half of France was under a government, the Vichy government, which tried to collaborate with the Germans in various ways. Okay. Again, the British wouldn't make peace, and the Germans thought, they improvised, you know, various strategies from knocking the British out of the war. This is the period of the Blitz, the preparation for a naval invasion of Britain. Doesn't work. But the Germans, during this period, had pretty much taken over all of Europe to the west of the Soviet Union. Not just France, but Belgium and Holland as well, and they had moved into Scandinavia earlier in the spring of 1940 to preempt British move into Norway. The Germans had conquered Norway and Denmark as well. They were allies with fascist Italy, semi-allies with Franco-Spain, which had won the Spanish Civil War and was staying out of the Second World War. Germany was clearly the dominant power in continental Europe. All right. But did this mean that the Germans felt they could just sit on their hands with peace or no peace? They could just live with the situation indefinitely? No. And why no? Because this is a very important factor in understanding the story. Because America was moving increasingly toward support of the British and toward active military intervention. The German sense that this was what President Franklin Roosevelt wanted, and they knew that for the time being, Roosevelt's hands were somewhat tied by public opinion, which was averse to direct military involvement, but a public opinion which, for a variety of reasons, believed that Britain should be supported, and that if Britain were allowed to collapse, the implications for American security, American freedom, would be very serious. So although in the initial period of the war there were limits on how far Roosevelt could go, it was clear which way things were moving. Why? I should just say briefly why it was that American opinion was isolationist. A lot of this had to do with the way the American involvement in the First World War was understood. And this is one area in which people who wrote on history did have an impact. There's a very famous book by Walter Millis, not a professional historian by any means. He was a journalist. He was the editorial writer for the New York Herald Tribune, which is the second most important newspaper in the United States in those days. Millis had written a book, came out, I think, in 1936 or so, called Road to War. And it was just this revisionist account of how the United States ended up in the First World War. Wilson had just a total bumbler. He allowed a de facto economic alliance between the United States and Britain, France to come into being during the period of non-belligerency. This kind of stacked the deck in terms of how the Americans reacted to what the Germans were doing. You know, we got involved in the war not knowing what we were doing. We just kind of slid into it kind of mindlessly. That's the view that Millis had in this book, Road to War. Now, the interesting thing here is that Millis wasn't an isolationist by any means. He was, in the pre-Pearl Harbor period, a very active interventionist. His view was that if we go to war, we should go to war knowing what we're doing. We should go into these things making conscious, deliberate decisions, you know, with our eyes open. Right? The whole purpose of the neutrality legislation, which limited the president's ability to conduct an interventionist policy, which limited the ability of banks and businesses in the United States to trade or to lend money to belligerents, was to make sure that if this happened again, it would be as a result of deliberate, conscious decisions, not because this kind of backdoor economic alliance had come into being that kind of, without anyone wanting it to do so, kind of had all these effects on the sorts of policies that were pursued. Right? So there were, you know, you had the neutrality legislation, very important. You know, Hitler was certainly aware of this, and Roosevelt's hands were tied to a certain degree. But even in September 1939, American public opinion favored the democracies against Nazi Germany. And then with the fall of France in June of 1940, there's a dramatic shift in American policy. You know, a heightening of the sense that we got to do more to help the British and the French. This is the period of the famous destroyers for bases deal that Roosevelt made with the British, where we gave the British some of these overage American destroyers, as they were called, in exchange for the British giving up the United States Navy basing rights and the British possessions in the Caribbean. You know, what's important is that it's the thrust of American policy. But Roosevelt is pushing, it seemed, toward intervention. Now, there was a limit to how far and how fast he could go in this direction imposed by domestic politics. 1940 was an election year, and the Republicans realized that they could kind of make hay electorally. You know, Roosevelt was running for an unprecedented third term by saying Roosevelt's a warmonger who's going to take the country into war. And Roosevelt, you know, just... stated very explicitly, unambiguously, I am not going to take the country into the war. Most notably in the speech he gave at Boston at the peak of the electoral campaign, right before the election in November. All right. But when the election had been won and Roosevelt was ensconced in the White House for another 4 years, you find a quickening of the pace, right? The proposal for Lend-Lease in early 1941. What's the whole idea of Lend-Lease? It's we don't want Britain to fall. Britain is our advanced bulwark, and we want to be able to enable them to continue the battle by harnessing American industry, giving them what they need to kind of fight the war. The implication of Lend-Lease is those goods that are going to be shipped to the British, we're not going to allow the Germans to attack the convoys that are delivering those goods. We'll protect those convoys, if necessary, by attacking German submarines preemptively, before they even launch their torpedoes. So you have this movement of Roosevelt in the direction of increased involvement. Okay. Very striking by early 41, but the signs of it are apparent. You look at the reports that were prepared by the German embassy in Washington during this period. It was all stuff was very clear. Now, what did this mean for Hitler? It meant that he was not a free agent. I mean, I think that this is like the most important insight into what was going on in this period that's developed past 20, 30 years. First by a German scholar named Andreas Hillgruber, who wrote an article in Germany. The title has something like The America Factor in Hitler's Strategy in 1940 to 41. And then even more important, this book that just came out a few years ago by Adam Tooze, I mentioned this before, Wages of Destruction. It's an amazing book. It's one of the handful of things that actually changed my own thinking about how this period is to be understood. It looks at the high politics of this period through a kind of a political economy lens. And one of the things that Tooze also shows is how large the America factor loomed for Hitler. Hitler's sense of America was gradually coming in, that Roosevelt wanted to take the country into the war on the anti-German side, that there was a limit to how far he could move, but he was kind of constantly stretching those limits. right? And what this meant was, to use a, you know, a term from international relations theory, that Hitler's window of opportunity was closing. Once the Americans came in, that would be it for Hitler. Not least because it would embolden the Soviets. If Germany had her hands full dealing with the United States, she would be much more pressure to Soviet much more vulnerable to Soviet pressure in her eastern border. What you had to do was clear the decks and strengthen your position before Roosevelt was able to take the United States into the war on the British side. And when you look at the German documents, it's very clear that Hitler decided to invade the Soviet Union with these considerations about the United States in mind. You see how pure power politics enters into these things. He said all continental European problems had to be resolved in 1941 because beginning in 1942, the USA will be in a position to intervene. When he set the date, spring of 1941, for the invasion of the Soviet Union, he said that was the earliest possible date because the German army had to be prepared for it. You had to wait till the spring to attack. But also the latest possible date with these considerations about America in mind, all right? See how all the different strands of the story are kind of coming together. So the Germans invade the Soviet Union, June of 1941. Huge initial successes, you know, terrible reverses for the Red Army. Germany is not able to achieve any decisive victory. The Americans, however, think that the Germans are going to win the war. They look at what's going on here. The Americans see their own window of opportunity closing. This part of the story, very important. The Americans aren't these kind of naive idealists or incapable of thinking in power terms. There's this body of strategic thought that developed at the highest levels of the American military in that period, beginning with a document called the Plan Dog Memorandum, prepared by Admiral Stark at the end of 1940, and culminates in something called the Victory Program of, get this, September 11th, 1941. What's the argument of the military? It's like saying, we can't just sit on our hands. Germany is consolidating our position in Europe. It's going to take the Germans a couple of years to bring order out of chaos in the areas that she's conquered. But when she does that, she'll be able to harness the vast war-making resources of all of Europe from the Atlantic Ocean to the Ural Mountains. Under Germany control and transform those economic resources into military power. And with internal lines of communication, this vast empire under German control, Germany will become essentially unconquerable, at least unconquerable at reasonable cost. Right? We can't wait for that to happen. Right? We have to move before it's too late, before Germany becomes unconquerable. Right? And that's the argument of a kind of key American strategist, an argument which Roosevelt basically shares. As a matter of fact, you look at his wartime at his speeches from 1941, the pre-Pearl Harbor period, and it is astonishing, given what you know we were all led to believe about how America was isolationist. Just to give you an extent, some sense for the extent to which these ideas are spread, I don't know if you remember, the very last page of the Taylor book, the very last paragraph in the Taylor book, when he says, Hitler's success depended on the isolation of Europe from the rest of the world. He gratuitously destroyed the source of his success. In 1941, he attacked Soviet Russia and declared war on the United States, two world powers who asked only to be left alone, right? It's gratuitous. It makes no sense. It's irrational in power terms. You know, he just, you know, goes to war with Russia, he goes to war with America gratuitously. Right? Very common views. See, no, it's not the case at all. Roosevelt says publicly, he has these very warlike comments in his public speeches, his fireside chats over the radio in those days, you know, about how Germany was a threat to the United States, how we kind of couldn't just sit on our hands, how stupid it would be for us to just wait until we ourselves were attacked, how we had to take the initiative, and in fact the United States in late 1941, right after the German attack on the Soviet Union, American policy, the pace quickens. American policy becomes far more active. We end up fighting an undeclared naval war in the North Atlantic against the German naval vessels, especially German submarines, in late 1941, right? Prior to Pearl Harbor, right? With the goal of provoking the Germans into the war. And just a few days, you know, after the put it this way, Churchill and Roosevelt. Churchill's the great wartime leader of Britain, Winston Churchill. He and Roosevelt meet in Placentia Bay off of Argentia, Newfoundland, at something called the Atlantic Conference. So you see it called under all these different titles. We'll call it Argentia, August of 1941. Early August, right as the undeclared naval war is about to begin. And Roosevelt explains his policy to Churchill. And he says, he basically makes it clear he wants to bring the Americans into the war. And he says he was skating on pretty thin ice with Congress, and that if he asked for a declaration of war, Congress would spend 3 months debating the issue. So he's not going to go that route. He would instead, quote, wage war but not declare it. This is from Churchill's report to the British cabinet about what Roosevelt said after he got back. He says he would become more and more provocative. His goal was to force an incident. He made it clear he would look for an incident which would justify him in opening hostilities. Right? He wants to provoke Hitler. He wants to bring the United States into the war against Germany. Okay? And the strategy doesn't work. Again, why does it not work? Was it because the Germans didn't care or didn't feel provoked? German Navy wanted to respond by going to war with America. Hitler restrained them. Why did he restrain them? Because he had his hands full in the East dealing with the Soviet Union. Right? Couldn't take on the Americans right now. Gave orders to his submarine command is to avoid contact with the Americans. Yeah? Yes?
The difference between strategic and tactical. If Hitler's not moving towards a broader war, if Hitler's moving towards a broader war, then that move not to engage the U.S. at that time is
a tactic.
Exactly.
So
the U.S. forcing the pace here is responsive to
exactly.
Action as opposed to provoking. The provocation is really in response to Hitler's growing aggression. So how do we kind of tease out Hitler's, you know, growing strength there with, you know, just tactical moves,
the distinction between tactical and strategic is not hard and fast. You would say Hitler's move into the Soviet Union was tactical? Well, in a sense, it was, because it was in the context of his sense that a confrontation with America is looming down the road. Would you say that America's sense for why it had to proceed in this way, why Roosevelt felt he had to bring the country into the war, tactical? No, because he had a sense for what Hitler's long-term goals were. And I should say, just the basis for Roosevelt's understanding of Hitler, again, it's what's being said in public. There's if you go to the Roosevelt Library at Hyde Park, New York, and you look up the documents relating to this issue, one of the key things there is there's an article in the Saturday Evening Post, a big magazine from that day, written by Joseph C. Harsh, who was their correspondent in Berlin, about what Germany's goals were. It's all marked up by Roosevelt. This is a source of information. There's no CIA in this period. Yeah, all these things are kind of, they're some mixed up with each other. It's hard to kind of draw these lines. Yeah, of course, Hitler's aggressive. But ideally, he would have proceeded at a very different pace. And, you know, it's like, it's not that clear whether he ultimately intended or wanted a war with the United States. But it's like, how can the Americans not behave that way? If we care about our own security, can we just sit on our hands while Hitler takes over all of Europe? On the other hand, if the Americans are coming into the war, you know, Hitler has a very strong incentive to act fast before this happens. But the faster he acts, the more we sense that our window of opportunity is closing and we're pushed forward too. And Roosevelt, he lays a lot of this stuff out to the country, arguing against a purely defensive policy, arguing for a policy of taking the war to Germany. So it's all quite extraordinary, right? All right, that's the context for approaching the whole question of the Far East. Because since Hitler doesn't respond to these American provocations, word provocation is Roosevelt's, not mine. Roosevelt has his problem. He agrees with the military. We've got to get involved in the war sooner than later. But his way of doing it, by provoking Hitler, this is not working. Is this then the key to understanding the coming of the U.S.-Japanese war? Because we entered the war, including the war against Germany itself, as a direct result of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And so the fundamental issue here is there any connection? Any connection between the whole European story, you know, of the movement toward a U.S.-German war, and the story of the origins of the war in the Pacific, the U.S.-Japanese war, right? So, okay. And so you have to look at the story of the road to Pearl Harbor. And right away, there, you know, if you approach this thing with the kind of sensibility that gets honed by studying international politics, you're struck by this big puzzle. In a sense, it's similar to the German puzzle. The Japanese puzzle is, here's Japan bogged down in this unwinnable war in China. Japan, I mentioned in passing, had embarked on a war in China in 1937. Right? Controls a lot of the coastal part of China, but not the interior. The war is continuing. And with her hands full with this war in China, she's going to gratuitously attack the country as strong as the United States, by far the strongest industrial power in the world. You know, if you look at the figures for steel production, America produces like 7 times as much steel as Japan. America's unconquerable by Japan. It doesn't make sense, right? Why would the Japanese do this kind of thing? Doesn't part of the answer have to do with what the Americans were doing? And so then the question is, well, what were the Americans doing? And again, it's not like the Americans were just sitting on their hands passively, minding their own business, and the Japanese attack is a bolt from the blue. And it's like, that attack on Pearl Harbor was the climax of a crisis that began on July 26, 1941, with the imposition of an oil embargo on Japan following the Japanese move down into southern Indochina. They had occupied northern Indochina in the previous year, and now they were taking advantage of the fact that the European powers were so weak, you know, France, Holland, and so on. They had been conquered by the Nazis, and Germany was Japan's ally. Japan, with the cooperation of the Vichy authorities, occupied southern Indochina in July. No American warning or anything, you know, about this, but the Americans respond by embargoing the shipment of petroleum to Japan. Not just from the United States, and you know, a lot of that oil, believe it or not, came from California in those days, but also oil supplies controlled by America's friends, the British and the Dutch. This is the Dutch government in exile. They control the oil fields in what was then the Dutch East Indies, contemporary Indonesia. And that was basically all the exportable oil in the world. Japan didn't rely on oil for her industrial economy. It was still a coal-based economy. But for military purposes, including naval purposes, Japan needed liquid fuels. Without liquid fuels, her armies in China would grind to a halt. She needed that oil if she was to avoid defeat So the whole question now is, are the Americans going to strike some sort of deal with Japan which would enable the Japanese to resume receiving these deliveries of oil? All right. Now, this whole business of the oil embargo, it's a very important part of the story. You all should understand the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo. What the implications of the oil embargo were. How can Japan get the oil? Two ways, in theory. Through a negotiated agreement with the United States, which would allow oil shipments to resume. Or by seizing the oil fields in the Dutch East Indies. Okay. So to avoid defeat in China, she needed to do one of those things. However, the Americans made it clear that if Japan did move and tried to take over control of the oil fields in the East Indies, that would mean war with the United States. So then, to avoid both war and a defeat in China, Japan needed a negotiated agreement with America. But the American terms were such that Japan couldn't hope for an agreement. What did we insist on? Basically, total Japanese withdrawal from China, a complete capitulation on the part of Japan. You know, just abandoning the entire effort that they had embarked on in China since 1937. Not including Manchuria, by the way, just China proper. Okay. Let me see if I can. Yeah. All this was, well, I'll put this off to just a minute. So Japan was in a corner. See, the Americans were basically saying the terms for an agreement are capitulation in China. No oil, that also was amounted to Japanese defeat in China. Military effort would grind to a halt. Seizing the oil fields meant war with America. So the choice would be between total defeat for Japan on the China question or war with the United States. That was the logic of the situation created by the oil embargo. What does this have to do with the war? Historians, they have no trouble looking back, recognizing that was the effect of the embargo, that it pushed Japan in a corner, that Japan faced with the choice between total capitulation to America and war with the United States, opted for war. And in order to put herself in the best position for that war, she opted for a first strike strategy, attacking the American fleet at Pearl Harbor at the very beginning of the war, only after it had become clear to Japan that war with America was inevitable. Right? All these things were understood in retrospect, and the historians don't have any problem seeing that the oil embargo put the United States on a collision course with Japan, given that we were not interested in a negotiated settlement with Japan. Okay? But most people think the last thing the Roosevelt administration wanted was war with Japan. Right? Most historians feel, yes, he wanted to take the United States into the war against Nazi Germany, but it's all the more reason to avoid the war with Japan. So why do you need a second war with Japan when your real enemy is Hitler? You know, it may, like these military officers who thought, you know, in terms of like the victory strategy and so on, they thought the Roosevelt policy was crazy. The policy of basically, putting America and Japan on a collision course. To them, this made no sense because they felt we should concentrate on Germany. So how do you square the circle, you know, for these historians? On the one hand, the oil embargo puts the two sides on a collision course. On the other hand, supposedly, Roosevelt does not want war with Japan. The U.S. government wants to avoid war with Japan. Right? And they come up, basically, with two possible ways of squaring that circle. One is, Roosevelt didn't know what he was doing. He thought the oil embargo would be a deterrent strategy. That he didn't realize that it would push the Japanese into the corner and lead directly to. And then there's the argument that whether he understood it or not, he wasn't in control of American policy. Without his knowledge or even awareness, the policy had effectively been seized by minor officials within the American government. It was the bureaucracy that shaped policy. Right? Okay. And by the time Roosevelt woke up and understood what was going on, it was too late to do anything about it. This is the argument. Okay. And when you think about it, it turns out those are the only two possible explanations. Because if Roosevelt knew what the implications of the embargo were, and he was in full control of the implementation of the policy, he was in full command, then the policy would have to be viewed as deliberate. So if it's not deliberate, either he wasn't in full control or he didn't know what he was doing. So you apply that method, and it serves to unpack the problem, and so you can analyze the different components of the problem one by one. Did he not know what he was doing? Turns out he certainly did. As a matter of fact, the reason he had avoided imposing an embargo for so long was that he said repeatedly within the government and even in public that an embargo would lead directly to a U.S.-Japanese. And his top advisor, Sumner Wells, said pretty much the same thing. He said in early July that tough economic sanctions like the oil embargo would provoke Japan to war with America before long. They understood that it could lead to war, probably. So then we're left with the other argument, the argument that Roosevelt had lost control over policymaking. And this is why the Utley book is so important. Because this is precisely the argument that Utley makes in this book. Policy, control over policy had been lost by Roosevelt. How was it that a country like the United States only wanted to avoid war with Japan, ended up at war with that country? It was because these mid-level officials who couldn't think in these long-range terms, had no political sense, they had effectively seized control of policy, hijacked it behind Roosevelt's back. If true, that would be a very important conclusion. And here we think we live in a democracy and the president is the politically responsible leader. And Utley is basically saying, no, it's these mid-level bureaucrats like Assistant Secretary of State Acheson who implement the embargo when Roosevelt said something much looser was in the works. So you can analyze that argument too. It turns out, no, it's not correct. And a key finding was made by a historian named Waldo Heinrichs in a book called Threshold of War. It's buried in this long footnote at the end of the book. You know, very few readers of that book would have even read the footnote unless they were sensitive to this issue. Okay? And Heinrichs went into these obscure parts of the archives, and he found out that, in fact, Acheson was taking his instructions from Wells, which meant from Roosevelt himself. And we also have the British records of the Argentia meeting in which they discussed the oil embargo issue. The Argentia meeting came just a few days after this, in which Roosevelt and Wells made it clear to the British that this was going to be a full embargo. Okay? So they're deliberately putting the United States and Japan on a collision course. How is this to be explained in light of the fact that Roosevelt wants to take the United States into the war against Germany? Doesn't it stand to reason that, having been frustrated by Hitler in his original policy of trying to provoke the Germans, now Roosevelt is looking for a second bow to his string and is trying to use the Japanese angle as a way of getting the Germans involved in the war against the United States? Because during this whole crisis, the Japanese are desperate to reach a deal. They're trying very, very hard to avoid war with America. Prince Konoye, who was the Prime Minister of Japan at the time the embargo is imposed, he gets rid of his anti-American Foreign Minister Matsuoka and replaces him with Admiral Toyota, who wants very much to reach a deal with America. They tell the American ambassador, Joseph Grew, that they're proposing a direct meeting on American soil between Konoye and Roosevelt. They said Konoye will agree to the American terms, whatever they are. Not good enough for the United States. This leads to the fall of the Konoye government. It's a replacement by a government headed by General Tojo. But the key figure there is their foreign minister, Togo Shigemori, T-O-G-O. And he tries, again, very hard to reach a settlement with the United States. The main proposal is called Plan B, the proposal for a modus vivendi. And the whole idea here is Japan will withdraw from southern Indochina, and the American oil shipments will resume at the pre-July level. Right? But even this, which a lot of people in the American government thought was quite reasonable. This is not just containment, you know. This is containment plus. The Japanese are pulling back. Not good enough. All right? I mean, to me, what all this suggests is that unless the Americans just didn't know what they were doing at all, the goal of the policy vis-a-vis Japan was to bring the Americans into the war with Germany. Why is this? Because you have Roosevelt basically in sympathy with the thinking of the military strategists, people like Admiral Stark and Army Chief of Staff Marshall, who had developed the victory program, that we got to go into the war soon rather than later. Right? He agreed with them about that whole strategy, but disagreed with them about Japan. So if he agreed with them about that strategy, but disagreed about Japan, something must have come into the balance that swung it in the opposite direction for Roosevelt, that something had to do with his sense that the American people would only come into a war not as an act of policy, but as a result of being attacked. Right? This is not Pearl Harbor conspiracy theory that he knew about the Pearl Harbor attack in advance. It's basically this crisis with Japan will lead America to get involved in the war of Germany. How did he know Germany would come in? The British had deciphered the correspondence, German diplomatic codes. The Americans had deciphered the Japanese diplomatic codes. The Germans were scared to death that Japan, as they knew, was trying very hard to reach a deal with the United States. And in an attempt to stiffen the Japanese, they promised repeatedly that if Japan got into a war with America, Germany would come into the war on Japan's side. Right? You look at all the evidence together, and what it suggests is that Pearl Harbor, not a bolt from the blue, not an act of aggression, pure and simple, right? But very much a product of a process in which American policy played a fundamental role. And do you sit in judgment on Roosevelt and say, oh, look how awful this was, how he took America into this war with Japan in a surreptitious way? So, well, if it was the only way of doing it, then who's to sit in judgment on it? But it shows the problems you get into when you rule out the idea that a country should make these decisions for political reasons and only go to war when it itself is attacked, right? If this case of the U.S.-Japanese War teaches us anything, it should teach us that. Okay, next time I'll try and review everything that we've covered in the course so far in preparation for the exam on Friday.